I'm John Batchelor. This is the John Batchelor Show. The United States government, the Treasury, the Obama administration, announces that it plans to sell its share of General Motors stock, at one point rated at 60% of all General Motors stock. It's a partner in controlling General Motors with the Canadian government and with the UAW. The surprise here is that it's going to sell it even though the stock price is disappointing at this point, well below the IPO and well below what I'm told is the necessary number, something around $50, for the government to get its money back, $50 billion or more. This from the bailouts of 2008 in the Bush administration and 2009 in the Obama administration. That's the news right now. It's also significant that the CEO of General Motors says that he was not consulted in this decision. It is a mystery to be solved. However, there are parts of the General Motors and government story that can be addressed now, even though they haven't yet been brought to the history books or the courts. Professor at George Mason University Foundation, professor also at the George Mason University School of Law, Todd Zwicky, who is a senior scholar at the Mercatus Center, writing recently for National Affairs, looks at the bailout of General Motors and Chrysler and the rule of law these last 3 years. Todd, very good evening to you. Thank you for this. Your historical eye certainly would flicker a little bit to hear this breaking news that the government is going to sell out what it achieved over these last 3 years. But let's go to your analysis before the government sells everything. In 2008, the Bush administration, working with Congress, working with is a euphemism, made a decision to put money from the TARP fund into General Motors and Chrysler in requiring them to come up with a reorganization plan in due time, knowing that the administration would change hands within the next month. That decision, that was part of what you call the fairy tale, that the government stepped in at the last moment, saw that General Motors and Chrysler were going to fail, fall completely apart. Hundreds of thousands of people would be unemployed, the whole economy of the Midwest would collapse, etc. The Obama administration, then coming in January, February, and March, and April, followed through with that fairy tale and put more money into General Motors and Chrysler, saw that the reorganization plan was not adequate, and then forced what we now understand to be a structured Chapter 11. Have I told the fairy tale correctly?
Yes, John, that pretty much tells the story.
Okay, and the end of the fairy tale, of course, is that everybody lives happily ever after. The companies reorganize. Chrysler is in the hands of the Italians. General Motors in the hands of geniuses. And nobody has anything to worry about except for this slight detail that the government is now going to end its relationship with General Motors at a loss. So that suggests, Todd, that your analysis is well taken, that something's wrong with the fairy tale. Let's start with the first thing you identify. What's wrong with the idea of going into Chapter 11 the way the Bush and Obama administration did?
The way they did it, just about everything's wrong with it, which is Chapter 11 is precisely structured to save and reorganize firms like Chrysler and General Motors, which is firms that have suffered because they've made bad decisions and have had bad management and bad labor contracts and everything else. But what Chapter 11 does is basically takes firms like that, gets them back on solid footing, and gets them to become productive and competitive again. And unfortunately, what we've seen and what I think perhaps this latest incident illustrates quite nicely is that rather than having just a good old-fashioned Chapter 11 where everybody takes their medicine and they recognize that they can no longer keep going on as business as usual, what instead we got was this sort of Frankenstein monster, this hybrid Chapter 11 combined with a bailout, which I think ended up leaving those firms worse off than they would have been if we had just let them go through Chapter 11 reorganized the normal way, as opposed to being companies that are structured to compete in the marketplace. What they are now is this sort of hybrid state-owned, state-entangled company where politics pervades every decision that these companies make, especially General Motors.
Professor, as I read your analysis, Chapter 11 is reorganization. Chapter 7 is liquidation. My memory, because I reported on this contemporaneously between the Bush and the Obama administration, it was an exciting time. America was falling apart. We were all going to lose our lives. Yes. But as I recall, the panic was if General Motors and Chrysler were going into Chapter 7, liquidation. They were going to end. They were going to lock the door and walk away, and the auto industry in America was going to end, no longer exist. That was never realistic, correct?
That was absolutely never realistic. These are firms that have long histories, that have a lot of name brand tied up in them. And, you know, fundamentally, in that sense, once they get their management and financial house in order, they're good investments. They're good companies that just made a lot of bad decisions through the years. But what bankruptcy basically does is ask the question, is this company worth more alive than dead going forward? I give the example of a typewriter company. If a typewriter company filed bankruptcy, that's the kind of company that goes into Chapter 7 because nobody's buying typewriters anymore. If General Motors files bankruptcy, that's exactly the kind of company that gets reorganized in bankruptcy and typically comes out a more competitive company than it was when they went in. So it was a complete fairy tale from the beginning to think that these were not companies, especially General Motors, that were going to reorganize successfully.
And you note that all the major airlines, almost every one of them, has gone through Chapter 11 reorganization over these years, and they're still flying, and they're still good investments, and they still make money. So let's move on to the next fairy tale. That is TARP itself. Boy, is this a controversial topic. Every Republican I talk to curses the day of the TARP vote in the House of Representatives. To this moment, Todd, to this moment. And the Democrats, well, they didn't much survive the 2010 election, so they're not here to ask. But the Bush administration, a Republican administration, made a decision to use TARP funds. The Obama administration, a Democratic administration, continued with that decision. You challenge the legality of that. How so?
Regardless of what one thinks of the TARP, and I tend to be with those who criticize the TARP, whatever one thinks of the TARP, one thing that is very clear is that the diversion of TARP funds to auto companies was blatantly illegal. It is very clear when the TARP was set up, is it is to be used for financial companies like banks. And perhaps the smoking gun in all of this is that Congress specifically voted down the use of or the allocation of funds for the auto companies. Why is that so significant? Well, the reason is if TARP money could already be used for the auto companies, why were they going through a vote to allocate new money to the auto companies? And basically what we saw was President Bush just ignoring, just blatantly violating the rule of law here, I think, and basically saying, we're going to go ahead and give TARP money to these auto companies, even though they never issued any serious legal opinion as to why that would be. So I think that's a really disheartening part about this whole thing, was just the high-handedness and the complete just ignoring what I think the limitations of the TARP are, even if you think the TARP was, regardless of whether you think it was a good or bad idea in the first place.
Has TARP ever been challenged in court, the use of the TARP for the auto companies?
Unfortunately, not in any real way. In the Chrysler case, the Indiana pensioners, the Indiana firemen and teachers, who are the ones among those who took it in the ear in the Chrysler case, they challenged it in the bankruptcy case in the lower courts, and the lower courts ducked it. And when it got up to the Supreme Court didn't take the case the first time around, and eventually it never got challenged, which I think is very unfortunate. I think it's very unfortunate that the Supreme Court didn't intervene in this case and take some of those questions very seriously, because I think, in my view, the use of TARP funds for this purpose is illegal.
And not only illegal, but it's going to lose money if the government follows through on selling General Motors below the IPO. Now, we turn to the question of how the bankruptcy was handled with regard to the secured bondholders, if I read this correctly, for both General Motors and Chrysler. First of all, what is a Section 363 sales, Professor?
That's basically where you can sell the assets of a company when they go into bankruptcy. But typically what you do is you sell some aspect of the company. You generally do not, and it appears that basically the bankruptcy code is set up so that you can't sell an entire company as an operating asset in this way. But basically what it does is it says, say you've got a division of your company that is underperforming. You can sell that as part of your bankruptcy case, but you don't essentially reorganize an entire company through the sale of the company, and especially you don't do it in a case like this where you're basically conducting a sham sale where basically, you know, they're, you know, General Motors and Chrysler in some sense were selling it to, you know, sort of going through the sham sale where they orchestrated who was going to buy it.
And that was how the bankruptcy was handled, the obliged bankruptcy at the direction of the Treasury Department. This is now the Obama administration. However, you make a very good case that the Obama administration abused, even trashed the rights of the secured bondholders. What does that mean?
Exactly. The way it's set up is that there are secure creditors and unsecured creditors. So an example is of a secure creditor would be somebody who holds your mortgage or the bank who loans you money for your car. And basically what it does is it gives them priority over other creditors. So if you default on your mortgage, the bank can foreclose and sell it. And credit card companies who are unsecured creditors get in line behind them. That's what we saw in Chrysler, was we saw secured bondholders who had a right, a first priority right to the assets of the company in bankruptcy. And then what you had were unsecured creditors, namely the United Auto Workers, who had claims for their pension funds and health care and that sort of thing. And one of the perhaps the most important rule in bankruptcy is that secured creditors, what we call higher priority creditors, get paid before lower priority creditors get paid. And in exchange, if you're a secured creditor, you take a lower interest rate because it's a lower risk loan. Instead, what we saw in Chrysler was that the government came in, orchestrated this whole thing. The secured creditors only got 29 cents on the dollar. The UAW got over 40 cents on the dollar. And so what we have is a complete perversion of typically what happens in bankruptcy.
And General Motors' secured creditors were treated better than Chrysler's secured creditors. Did the Obama administration explain that discrimination?
That's one of the points I make, is that the Obama administration decided to stick it to the secured creditors and Chrysler, but then in General Motors decided to give the secured creditors first priority and give them 100 cents on the dollar. Now, in some sense, you might say, well, maybe they learned their lesson, but in another sense, it's even more disturbing, because what it looks like is the only reason they decided not to stick it to the secured creditors in General Motors was because they didn't think they had to, because the secured creditors, there weren't as many secured creditors in General Motors, and so they didn't have to fleece them in order to get what they wanted. That's the kind of high-handedness and arbitrariness that really destabilizes an economy.
Now, quickly, the ad hoc part of these bankruptcies. I reported on how so many dealerships were to be closed, the blow to regions throughout the country. But then slowly, what I also found were dealerships were being kept open because of intervention by Democratic office holders, either governors or representatives, or you mentioned Senator Klobuchar of Minnesota. And there didn't seem to be a pattern to it other than whoever had the most influence in Washington. That again raises the question of how this was handled by the Obama administration.
Exactly. And this is the point I made at the beginning, is that what bankruptcy is supposed to do is create a non-political process where what you focus on is what's going to make this company stronger going forward. Instead, what we got was essentially a situation where we had 535 new members of the board of directors of Chrysler and General Motors. And basically what we had were politicians weighing in, trying to keep dealerships open. Barney Frank lobbied in to keep intervene to keep open a manufacturing plant in his district in Massachusetts. We had politicians from Montana trying to intervene in mining operations. And basically what they decided was, we gave you the money, now we get to tell you how to run your company. And I think that's exactly the kind of political state capitalism that we see in third world countries, where politicians feel where they're intertwined with business, and they start running businesses along political lines rather than along efficient free market lines.
Is this an example that will teach the future, or is this a dark episode that must be in some way explained? Are we going to use this as a precedent, or is this a curse on us, Professor?
Well, that's what caused me to write this article. Is my concern was, what I was reading was that everybody was saying that this was a smashing success. And as soon as people decide it's a success, then that sets the precedent for people to do it again in the future. And why I thought it was so important was to sit down and explain why this was not a success, why not only was this unnecessary, because these companies could have reorganized without bailouts, but that, in fact, it's the opposite of success, in that I think the companies, General Motors, for instance, is going to turn out to be a weaker competitor now that they're saddled with these political barnacles of keeping open dealerships that may have been efficiently closed, being strong-armed into building green cars that nobody wants. I mean, the whole nine yards of things that come along with the political strings. And so what I'm hoping is that people recognize in the future that this is the kind of thing to be avoided for the good of the economy. We're always going to have well-greased and powerful special interests like the United Auto Workers. You're going to run the flag up to basically get a preferential treatment. And if the story of General Motors and Chrysler is a success, then those special interest leaders are going to be able to hide behind that story and basically claim, as they used to, what's good for General Motors is good for America.
Todd Zawicki is the George Mason University Foundation Professor at George Mason University School of Law. He's also a senior scholar at the Mercatus Center. I'm John Batchelor. This is the John Batchelor Show.